make an announcement.
I'm Bob Darrell, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
We're going to break at 12 noon from 12 to 2 for lunch. I'm told that there are some things about different local restaurants over there with some coupons and directions, etc., etc. Ready?
Oh, yes. That's on.
So, okay, lack of power is our dilemma. We saw that if we could lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe, that we'll commence to get some results. But I think for most of us, those results are transitory. How often we see people come into the program and they'll get through the step two or step three wall. And then all of a sudden, okay, they've gotten rid of their prejudice now, and now they're willing to believe in God. And there's a sense with some of us at that point that we've arrived somewhere. Right? And that's really only the beginning. It's really only the beginning, because what will happen inevitably is that whatever surrender has occurred will evaporate in time. And we will be blocked again from God. And so, how do we access that power? Well, it's really through a process that's designed to do just that with the remaining steps. And on page 55 is a vision of exactly what will happen to us in steps 4 through 9. It's a vision of how, where, and when we will access this power. Years ago, I heard a story probably 30 years ago, and it really defined what had happened to me in about 7 years of relapsing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the story was about this young boy who lived on a farm out in the country, and they were self-sufficient. And one day he was out along the front of the property on the highway mending fence for his dad. And he looked up and there was a telephone pole along the road. And on the side of the pole was this big bright yellow poster. And it said circus and had a date on it that was in a couple weeks away. And on the poster it had pictures of clowns and lions. And he didn't know what a circus was, but it looked like it was something very exciting. And it said price of admission was $1. And he went back to the house and he said, he was excited. He said, "Hey, Papa, there's a circus coming to town. If I work hard, can I have $1 and go to see the circus?" And his dad said, "Well, sure, son." And the day of the circus came and he was up before dawn, did his chores, and his dad gives him a silver dollar and sends him off into town. He gets into town and he gets up to Main Street. There's a big crowd of people on the Main Street. And because he's a little kid, he kind of weasels his way up through that crowd, gets right up to the curb, and as he gets up to the curb, coming down the streets, this parade. And leading the parade is a bunch of clowns, and they're juggling stuff, and they're brightly colored outfits with all kinds of makeup, and big red noses, and weird hair, and never seen anything like it. Behind the clowns were these beautiful white stallions, and these women were standing on the back of these stallions right down the street. And he'd never seen anything like that. And behind that were this wagon with this giraffe's neck sticking out the top of it. And he'd never seen a giraffe. It was just amazing to him. And behind the giraffe were wagons with cages with lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. And he's just enthralled, and more acrobats, and more clowns, and then elephants, a whole bunch of elephants riding down the street with people on top of them. And then finally, at the very end of the parade, is this one little clown. He's kind of dancing around down behind the last wagon. And the little kid realizes it's the end, and he has the silver dollar, and he shows it to the clown, and the clown tips his hat. The kid doesn't know what to do, so he throws the silver dollar. Clown catches it, puts it on his head, bows to the kid, and dances down the street. And the kid goes home, excited to tell his dad about him seeing the circus. The problem is he never saw the circus. He never got into the big top. He only ever saw the passing parade. And I was 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never got in the big top. But I was part of the passing parade. And sometimes the passing parade is the parade on its way to the graveyard. And I was part of that. And the sad part is I didn't know that there was more here. I didn't know, because if you're suffering, whether you're brand new sober or you're 10 years sober, and you're suffering from alcoholism, and your emotions are just on you, and you're everything that it talks about on page 52, and it says having trouble with personal relationships, couldn't control our emotional natures, a prey to misery and depression, couldn't make a living, had a feeling of uselessness, were full of fear, were unhappy, and couldn't be of real help to other people. That coupled with what Silkworth referred to as we become restless, irritable, and discontent is a pretty good description of what it feels like without having alcoholism without the benefit of any type of emotional anesthetic. And if you're suffering from that, or maybe you're brand new and you came down and you just burnt your life to the ground and you're full of hopelessness and remorse and depression, and you look at the steps, there's never been a case yet of an alcoholic in that position looking at the steps and going, oh yeah, that would work, yeah. The steps don't look like they'll work until after you try them. And you don't know that the power's there until you know that the power's there. You don't access God until you access God. And what happens to most of us, it talks about this in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, is that we're brought here not by virtue. I don't even think it's our decision. It's through a lack of alternatives and circumstance. There's like nowhere else to go. You've tried everything, haven't you? And there you are. It's all failed. Absolute collapse of all human resources. And on page 55, it starts to tell us or give us a vision of what we're going to find in steps 4 through 9. It says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down within me. I remember watching Chuck Chamberlain after he spoke at our intergroup meeting, and I was standing in the line to thank him. And there was a guy, a couple people up ahead of me in the line, that asked Chuck, when he got up to the head of the line, said to Chuck, well, where do you find God? And I remember Chuck cackling with him, this funny little laugh, and pointing in the guy's chest and saying, he's not lost, he's right in there. I used to hear the old timers talk about listening to the still small voice of God within. I remember one time being at a meeting. I wasn't sober very long, hadn't worked the steps yet. And this, I just started praying. I'd been praying a little while. And this woman talked about how she just liked to be alone without the TV, without the radio, just her communing with herself and God. And I remember thinking, yeah, that's good. I'm going to go home and be quiet, just commune with me and God. And that just sounded like a great thing to do. And I went home and I just didn't turn the TV on, no stereo, just me alone with me and God. And you know what happens to me with untreated alcoholism? When it gets quiet out here, it gets very noisy in here. And I don't run into God when I go inside me. I run into Legion. I mean, it's like, wow. 30 seconds, I'm turning the TV on. I can't take it anymore. So what's this about? Everybody says that this thing is inside them. And I don't run into God inside of me. I run into just a massive, crazy, insane clamoring. Well, because this thing inside me is blocked from me. And the book says it may be obscured. It may be blocked by three things. And oddly enough, these are the three things that are addressed primarily in step four. The first thing is by calamity. Bill Wilson uses the word, the things that cut him off from God are worldly clamors. I'm a guy who likes calamity. I like excitement. I like the edge. I don't like going over the edge, but I like the view from the edge. I'm the kind of guy that goes to an amusement park and they might have one of those make you scream and think you're going to die roller coasters and then a little merry-go-round. I won't even notice the merry-go-round. I saw that roller coaster from the parking lot. Whether I go on it or not, it's got my attention. If I'd have walked in here this morning and set a half gallon of vodka on this table and then a bottle of milk, everybody in this room would have seen that vodka. Some of you might not have even noticed the milk. But you'll see the vodka. I am one of those kind of guys that just gravitates towards that kind of stuff. I'm a producer, as it says later in the book, of confusion rather than harmony. I'm a guy who likes to get things spinning. I'm a producer of calamity. And consequently, as a result of living life on self-will, I produce an clamorous internal life based on all the fears and all the things I'm in conflict with and the resentments that I have to justify, and there's a voice for every justification. I'm full of myself and my own self's clamoring. And there's no God inside of me. Because I'm totally full of me. If you wanted to hear the sound of clamor or calamity, imagine on a bad day that a surgeon could surgically implant a microphone into your brain connected to loudspeakers, and we would get to hear everything you think. We would hear calamity. I mean, if you're like me, with a mind like I had when I got sober, if God was inside me, even if he had a megaphone, I'm not going to hear him over the noise in my head. This line's one of my favorite lines in a movie. You ever seen the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy? There's a line in there where this guy turns to somebody and says, "Excuse me, is the noise in my head bothering you?" That's a great line. "Is the noise in my head bothering you?" So it's obscured by calamity, by pomp. Pomp's another, I think, is a great word for ego. Is that I just get so full of myself and I'm so right about so much stuff. And I have such a... I'm so judgmental and so puffed up with me. I'm like a glass of water full to the top. There's not room for anything else. My problem has always been, unbeknownst to me, is that I'm too full of me to have any room for God. I got too much of me between me and God. And then the third thing is worship of other things. You couldn't have convinced me when I got sober that I worshipped anything. You might have been able to convince me that when I was drinking, I may have, in some bizarre sense, worshipped alcohol and drugs, I suppose. But you couldn't, now that I'm sober, convince me I worshipped anything. And I worshipped a lot, and I didn't even know it, because I don't know what that means. And I was ending my first, at a little over a year sober, I was ending my first sober relationship. And I got to tell you something, I sponsor a lot of guys that have relationship problems. I don't think there's a person on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. You can go up to a person like that and say, I just came from the doctor of terminal cancer, 2 weeks to live, and he'll go, do you know what else she did? I mean, it just gets on you. You can't get it off. And that's what's happened. It's on me. And I'm so wacky, I don't know what to do. So I just go into a lot of meetings, and I go to this meeting at night. And I'm just nuts. I'm thinking maybe I'll hear something, but nothing gets in. Because what's happening is that what's going on in the meeting is so distant for me, because I'm so focused up in here thinking about if I ran into her, I could say this, and then she'd probably say that, and then I'll tell her this, and then she'll say that, and then I'll hit her with this. Oh, she'll realize how wrong she is. Be properly ashamed of herself. You know, and so I'm not spinning all this stuff. And she's a member of AA, but she's not in the meeting I'm in, which means that a spring is attached to the back of my neck, is attached to the door. Every time the door to the meeting room opens up, I go like this. Not her. You know? So by the end of the meeting, I've not heard anything. Matter of fact, I'm worse. It's one of those meetings that's full of happy couples. What's that about? What does sometimes God just put on his Bozo the Clown nose or what? I mean, why is that happening? Did you ever notice how that's a weird deal? And I don't know what to do. I'm a mess. There's a guy visiting from California, sober a lot of years, 20-some years. He wants to ride back to his hotel, and I said, okay, can we go out and get some pie and coffee first, and we used to do that after meetings, and went to the place where a lot of people in AA usually go after the meeting, and we're sitting, I got this guy alone in this booth, and we're sitting there, and I kind of have him hostage because I'm his ride. So I start telling him about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes till his eyes have glazed over. He's a very, very polite man, and he sits there and he's nodding and listening to me. And when I ran out of gas, he started to say some things to me that was just mind-boggling. He said to me, he says, kid, have you ever thought about the first commandment? When he said that, I kind of bristled with a little bit of antagonism. I said to him, I'm not really into that. I'm just into AA. And he starts to laugh. He goes, yeah, I know. He says, you and I are a lot alike. He said, guys like us, we have a hard time getting past the thou shalt not. He said, in my experience, the Ten Commandments were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. The first commandment, as it exists today in the English, is I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have false gods before me. He said, somewhere along the line, when it was translated, probably from the Aramaic into the Greek, it got an authoritarian spin put on it. He said, but I believe from my experience that God loves me unconditionally and absolutely. That I can put anything I want between me and God will still love me. The problem is, I've just put something between me and God. I've blocked the light. He said, when you worship something, it doesn't mean to bow down to. It means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards me. He said, if you want to know what you're worshiping in your life, it's very simple. He said, at the end of your day, make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking of, and the thing that owns the pie would obviously be the thing you have been turning your consciousness obsessively towards. When he did that, I could picture this pie graph. And a little sliver for AA, a little bit of work, and the rest of it was the relationship. And I knew at that moment why I was in such desolation. Why it felt like somebody had crimped the oxygen hose to my being. That I had just put something between me and God. And it was the relationship. And I discovered over the years that what it says in the book is really right when it says that lack of power is our dilemma. I will always obsessively turn towards things that can give me an illusion or a possibility of power. Money is a big deal. I bet you half the people in this room are unconsciously convinced if they had enough money, now I don't know what enough is, 500 million, but there's a figure somewhere, there's a figure that if you had it, I mean you probably need not just one Learjet, you probably need two or three, but if there's a figure somewhere, then you would have surely at that point, with that amount of money, have rested happiness and satisfaction. You would have found the power through the money to secure emotionally and materially and validate yourself as a person. You would have filled your vacancies and holes and be complete. That's the great illusion. Sex is another one. The idea that finding the right person to love me the right way would somehow complete me. Did you ever see that movie Jerry Maguire? There's a very touching romantic thing in there where they're in the elevator and this guy's talking to this girl in sign language and she says, almost teared up, she says, he said to her that she completes him. Well, it's very touching and mushy and everything, but the implication is that as is, there's something wrong with you. That God made you incomplete and we buy into that. Why do we buy into that? Because it feels like it, doesn't it? I've gone through my life obsessively looking for a missing piece and misinterpreting what the piece is. It's really a God-shaped hole. Most of the guys I sponsored, 90 days sober, they're absolutely convinced it's a woman-shaped hole. Or, it's a Harley Davidson shaped hole. It's $1 million shaped hole. And we misinterpret the vacancy. And why would that? Because you can see the girl, you can see the money, you can see the motorcycle, you can see the house, you can't see God. And through a process of elimination, because don't we get all that stuff, some of us? And it ain't it. It ain't it. This idea that I can fill the vacancy within me through acquisition is what destroys most of us. And because we go for it. And we're alcoholic. We go for it like gangbusters. I know guys that have gotten sober and thrown themselves into obsessively filling their vacancies, and then at 15 or 20 years sober in a $5 million house, they blow their brains out. Right? They got everything that came on the radar that could possibly maybe fill these vacancies. The wife, the kids, the house, the whole deal. Because it's a misinterpreted search and a yearning. Carl Jung said it the best. When our thirst, whether it's for alcohol or anything else, is really not a thirst for what we think it is. It's a misinterpreted thirst for a unity with God. It's a God hole. It never looks like it, does it? You ever been driven by your own vacancies in the middle of it go, oh, I'm really yearning for God. I live in Las Vegas where people's yearning. I mean, the God hole within them brings more people to Vegas than the advertisements on the Travel Channel. It's a misinterpreted yearning for God. But in some form or other, it is there. Obscured by all this stuff, for faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. From the very beginning of time, because it rests within the human heart, from the very beginning of time in every culture, every country, every village, every state. People talked about, in different words, the seeking of this, of a connection with some sort of power that they're obscured from. They called it a lot of different names. They called it a lot of different things. But it is comes from the yearning in the human heart. It is as real as we are. We finally saw that some kind of faith and some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but He was there. Where? Deep down within me. Search fearlessly. Where else does it use those two words together in the same line? Step four. Fearless and searching moral inventory. Isn't it odd that in the third step promises on page 63, it does not promise us a nearness to our Creator. It does not promise us in the third step as a result of a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God. It does not promise you at that point that you will begin to have a spiritual experience. It is not until the fifth step promises on page 75 that it says, now we will start to feel the nearness of our Creator. Frank Buckman, who was the founder of the Oxford Group, which a lot of our spiritual principles were derived from Buckman. Buckman believed that you could not possibly turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Don't even try until you first clean house. You're too blocked. Buckman had an experience in England. Buckman's, the bedevilments on page 52 were pretty good experience, pretty good description of Buckman's condition when he had this experience. He was pretty much washed up. He was a guy who wanted to be a minister. He wanted to serve God's kids. He wanted to help people. He wanted to be significant spiritually in the world. And he was a failure. And in a desperate, depressed moment, a friend of his said, come on, let's go down to the Salvation Army, which is on Skid Row in London. Back in the 20s, he said, let's go down there and listen to this woman testify. And Buckman, because he was in a bad spot, went along. And he was not normally that way. Buckman was a weird kind of guy. First of all, he was kind of a chauvinistic guy. So for him to go hear a message from a woman was not in character or nature to him.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of prejudices. And secondly, Buckman always thought that spirituality equated itself to the rich. Not Skid Row. You don't hear a message on Skid Row. You hear it in the Towers of Finance. As a matter of fact, Buckman and Wilson's big falling out is Buckman was pushed just to push Wilson. Wanted Wilson to get down to Wall Street and minister to the captains of industry and bring them into the Oxford Group. And Bill wanted to go find guys like me down at Skid Row at the Calvary Mission at Towns Hospital. So for Buckman to go down to Skid Row to a Salvation Army in inner city London and listen to some woman testify, was a, you know, he was not on his feed. And what she said blew his mind. She described him. She described everything he was experiencing. This disconnection from God and this inability to be of real help to other people. The depression, the feeling of uselessness, everything. And then she said something he never heard before. She said, if the problem is you're distant from God and your ability to help His kids, the answer is not in more prayer. The answer is you've got to remove the blockage. And Buckman sat there and went, oh my God. I am blocked from God. And it became the basic premise for moral rearmament, which was later named the Oxford Group. So deep down in us, this thing is obscured. And it is only through a searching and fearless... It's almost like I'm looking for a diamond at the bottom of a dung heap. Underneath all the resentments and the petty, immature, childish judgments, underneath all the pathetic fears that are so self-involved, underneath all the shameful sex conduct where I'm just trying to gratify myself excessively, underneath all of that is God. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality. What a tremendous, tremendous word for God. Capital letters, the great reality. Deep down within us. In chapter 5, it's read at every meeting, and they tell you in there where you're going to find God. It says, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him in a place most alcoholics seldom visit. Now. We're not now people. We're thinkers. Matter of fact, even as I'm saying that, some of you are thinking, oh, what page was that? And, oh, I can't wait to tell Joe that. That's very clever. You're not even here when I'm saying, you heard it and then went, where'd you go? Well, it's a promise again. I'm not a now guy. I have this fantasy, if I die and go to heaven, before they let me in, St. Pete will come and say, well, Bob, we're going to let you in, but I want you to take an honest reckoning of your life. You were on earth, Bob, 85 years. We think you were actually present about 2.5 months. The rest of the time you were thinking. But if you want to be in the presence, you've got to be in the present. That's where God is. Right now. Which is not good for thinkers. Where I think I'm the kind of guy that will see the most beautiful sunset I've ever seen in my life. And it'll be 20 minutes long. I'll actually experience 15 seconds of it, and the rest of the time I'm thinking about, that color looks a little like that, and oh man, I should have got, where's my camera? Because I'm a thinker. And I think that's part of what it is to be self-focused, self-centered. But we found the great reality deep down within us. And in the last analysis, after I've looked everywhere else, it is only there that he can be found. It was so with us. Only deep down within me, after I've looked everywhere else. And I think that's a pretty common thing with us. You know, they used to refer to Alcoholics Anonymous as the last house on the block. I mean, all the stuff that it talks about in chapter 3 that we tried to fix ourselves, health farms, sanitariums, medications, changing towns, switching from scotch to... We've done everything we can looking for help for our alcoholism, and we come to Alcoholics Anonymous usually when we've exhausted everything else. And then, for some of us, who are surrendered by the bottle, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we look for power everywhere else. And don't even know it. I did. My first 4 years or better in sobriety, I looked for power everywhere else. I went through 9 jobs. In 4 years, multiple relationships. I had every service position. I went to 15, 20 meetings a week. I bought stuff. I went through a gambling thing that lasted 1.5 years that almost took my life. All seeking power. And yet, I go to a meeting every day. And they read the same thing in every single meeting, sometimes, most of the time, 2 meetings a day. And these are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. And I'm thinking, yeah, I need a new job. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. oh, I could be very spiritual with her. These are the steps we took, what you're suggesting is a program recovery. I need a motorcycle. These are the steps we took, what you're suggesting is a program recovery. Period. And sometimes, as a result of exhausting everything that seems to be on the horizon that a guy like me could imagine was going to make me better, give me some kind of security, validation, power, and finding none, I turn within to the journey through the steps to the power. When there's nothing left. When there's nothing left. I think some of us get to a point, they used to talk about it in the 70s a lot, the second surrender. You're brought here surrendered by the bottle, and then in sobriety, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you will be surrendered by life itself. The way Chuck said, you will get to that point where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And there you are. And there you are. And I think it is at that point that guys like me really and truly stood at the turning point where I would seek his protection and care with complete abandon. And then the problem is I can't abandon. That's what steps 4 through 9 are about. To reduce me. Spiritual growth is never from addition, it's always from subtraction. It's always from getting rid of, not acquiring more of. How many of us think that we can move towards God by education or knowledge or read enough spiritual books? I want to read enough spiritual books and do enough meditation that I kind of glow in the dark. And yet, it never works that way. So this is the journey. And it really starts with step 3 on page 60. And I'm going to do about 5 minutes and then turn it over to Katie. Step 3 is... I had two minor problems with step 3. Step 1 and step 2. Especially the second half of step 1. This is so funny because I'm the guy that would have told you and shared in meetings how my life's unmanageable. But if you'd have watched me, I conducted myself as if I was a guy who really believed he could manage his own life if he just tried a little harder. And what is real? It's not what I say, it's not what I think. It's not what I feel, it is what I do. You want to know where Bob's really at? Watch Bob for a while. Watch it. Watch me. You'll see. Don't believe what I say. I am absolutely capable of saying one thing and doing another. Mm-hmm. Absolutely capable of that. Hopefully, through this program, I get integrity, which means I integrate what I say and what I do. Do I become one person? Chuck used to say you cannot compartmentalize your life. You can't be one thing over here and one thing you have to. Hell exists between being two different things. An abyss between them. Be one. Be one thing. That's what's the first principle that your sponsor will teach you. If you're sponsored anything like the guys I've had, they'll say things to you like, do what you say you're going to do, kid. Show up where you say you're going to show up. Be the guy you told them you were going to be. To get one, to become one. So my two problems are with step 1 and step 2. Once I am convinced of the ABCs or step 1 and step 2, that I am alcoholic and cannot manage my own life, period. I thought that my life was unmanageable because I drank. Oh, was I in for a surprise? Actually, my life is more unmanageable sober because now I'm going at it with the same tools I went at it before without the benefit of anesthetic. The real life inside of me, my emotions is what's really, in my internal life is what's really so unmanageable. I'm still afraid of misery and depression, I still have those feelings of anxious apartness where I can't connect with people with any kind of intimacy that I observe in others. I can't manage my own life. Sober. Through my very best efforts, going to 2 meetings a day, and I still can't manage my own life. If probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism, I, drunk and sober, I sought power and failed. That God could and would if He were sought. And if step one and step two are you're convinced to them, in a sense, you have made the decision. It's automatic. The word decision comes from a Latin word, scissore, meaning to cut away. Scissore means to cut. It's the same root word as the word scissors or the word incision. When a surgeon cuts in to a patient, a decision is you cut away the alternatives, and what's left is there is either a God that's going to, I can surrender myself to, and the word surrender comes from 2 Latin words, sur, meaning above, like in surface, and render, like in a rendering plant, to return back to. The word surrender means to return or give back to above, or to a power greater than ourselves. Either there is a God that I can surrender to, or I'm screwed. I'm screwed. When I was new, a guy named Joe cornered me after a meeting. And I hope I never forget this. I think he might have heard this on a tape, but I don't know where he got it from for sure. But Joe cornered me and he said to me, he says, "Kid, you got to take step 3. And I said to Joe, I said, "Joe, I got to tell you the truth, I can't." He said, "What do you mean you can't?" I said, "Well, I don't really know if there's a God or not. I don't believe in God." He said, "You don't have to believe in God to take step 3. I said, "Joe, that's what it says. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I don't have that." He said, "Listen, kid, in your case, if you will turn your will and your life over to this chair," and he points to a chair, he says, "I promise you an instantaneous miracle." So I said, "Oh, what the hell? All right, I turned my will and my life over to the chair, Joe. What's the miracle?" He said, "Well," it's this big smile on his face, he said, "the miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot." And I didn't even get mad. I just sat there and thought, "Yeah, that'd be right." Yeah. Because if you would have observed me drunk and sober, as I went through 9 jobs in 4 years, as I ruined one relationship after another, as I was judging my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a horse of self-righteousness, you would have instantly became aware of a guy who you would think to yourself, "Whoever's making decisions for this guy is out to destroy him." And yet, isn't it funny, inside me, it never looks that way to me. The rest of the world can see Bob the way Bob is. Bob sees the story I tell myself about Bob. I don't see me. Our book calls it self-delusion. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Katie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, Bob. Katie, alcoholic.
Katie.
I want you guys to do something real quick. I want you to just push your chair back, stand up. Let's kind of shake out. We have to go an hour and 25 minutes, and you cigarette smokers, your butt's getting tight, and it's my turn. So. Yeah. So come on, shake it around, stretch it out. You got to get the blood flowing, otherwise you're falling asleep. You're awake for Bob, and you're asleep for me. So there you go. By golly, I'm taking second fiddle here. Come on. Look, you're getting ready. Don't you go out and smoke now. Sit back down. You're sneaking out that back door. Okay, everybody, sit back down. Okay, now, we're getting ready to start. I just wanted to give you those few minutes to kind of shake it out. This, I get to do the third step or start the third step. This is my favorite step in the whole wide world. I got to tell you, I've been looking at Bob's book because I love looking at people's big books, you know, and seeing all the scribble in there and what they see is important, what they underline, what means a lot to them. And I hope the longer you're sober that the third step is the most marked up part of your book. Because he is, we got color coding going on here or something. You got greens and orange and reds. And Charlie says, my book, you can tell from a side view that it's just dirty. Right at 60 to 63. I mean, it falls open because, you know, it's the root of our problem. That's probably where we need to live, is in what this is talking about. So I'll give you a little story about it. Once again, as you know, big book thumper for 3 years into my sobriety, walked away from the program as far as, you know, doing any sort of work in the book, went into, found Jesus, loved Jesus, don't get me wrong if that insulted anybody, especially with Billy Graham Highway out there. I thought I better make that real clear here where I stand. I wasn't sure if it was Dale Earnhardt or Billy Graham, but I'm not sure who you're worshiping, but so I went off into Jesus and got completely lost and confused, came back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then did what I call meeting-based sobriety, which is where I was making meetings and never touching my book, didn't know where my book was, didn't work any steps, just went to meetings, and it got me. The problem with that is you get the relief when you go to a meeting. Somebody says that magic. Now, don't get me wrong. That's not bad. The only problem is when that's the only kind of program you're working, you never accomplish the freedom that the 12 steps give you. You see what I'm saying? For some reason, if you get relief in a meeting, I'm not saying that's bad at all. I'm saying it's bad when that's all you're getting is that relief. And you've got the relief until you get to another meeting. And you got to hear that pearl of wisdom, right? And so we're asking you to look at the steps and get through it that way. And so my sponsor, I call her, and remember now, my husband has died. I'm in untreated alcoholism. I was married 20 years to another, recovered alcoholic in AA. And it was a great life as far as I was concerned. I was very crazy about this man. He was crazy about me. Us ending our relationship was never an option, period. Divorce was not an option between Joe and I. And when he got sick, there was no doubt in my mind I would stand by my husband, period. I made that commitment. As a matter of fact, as Charlie knows today, my husband, I am so committed. I am a committed gal, boy. You and I are going to do the marriage thing. We're going to do the marriage thing. Now, there are 3 deal breakers. You screw around on me, you're going to probably have to, I'm going to have to take your life. I am an alcoholic, yes, and a woman. So we can all get kind of bobbited around, if you know what I'm saying. And then, I was trying to catch on that one there, Bob. So, unfaithful, beat me, and if you drink, it's a deal breaker. I'm going to probably have to be out of here.
You'd be better off drinking.
Those are my three deals. And the truth of the matter is otherwise, I'm committed. That sounds like a pretty good deal, doesn't it? Look at that. You women should be nodding your heads to me. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And so when Joe gets sick, he passes away. I am 18 months into Joe's death. Charlie and I are dating. I am crazy. I'm in untreated alcoholism. I am the tornado ripping through the lives. It's terrible. I finally realized, my God, I've got to get this AA thing. I've got to start looking at it, you know. And I'm sitting out there. I'm doing what Bob is saying. I am talking to God. I am so blocked with resentment, so blocked with loneliness, self pity. Yeah, I'm thinking. So that was it, God. You gave me my one shot, huh? You gave me my one shot in early sobriety. I got nothing. Yeah, great. You know, are you even listening? That whole hopeless prayer I think we've all made. So I decided maybe I should get a sponsor. My best thinking. So I called this gal. And
I tell her the story, and she knows of Joe and I. As I told you, we were Mr. and Miss AA in the early day, and they were all from our litter. And she says, you know, Katie, I'm sorry to hear how much pain you're in. That must have been really difficult about you and Joe, and blah, 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 blah. She says, but I want you to, when we get off the phone, I want you to read page 60 to 63. Now, I haven't touched the book, right? Okay, I'm thinking, thank God somebody's finally heard me. I'm going to turn over to the page that probably says, you are a good woman. God will love you no matter what. Right? I've got all these things. Well, my book opens to page 62. It just opened right there. And I see, the first thing I see is selfishness and self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our trouble. I thought, well, forgive me. I thought, well, that bitch. That was my first, I mean, boom, 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 boom. That was how my thinking went. I thought, did she not hear a word I was saying? And long story short, she told me where I had walked from sorrow to self-pity. See, I waved that flag that you can't touch me because I've lost my husband. And the only way you could trump me, and I remember having this thought in a meeting, the only way you could trump me in an AA meeting is if you'd lost a child. You won. That's my thinking. Now, I'm not thinking it during the time, but when it says when we look back, once I start getting this God consciousness, it's like somebody reran my life in front of me and I went, oh my God. Wow. It's all over me. See, I'm blinded to it when I'm in the middle of it. So this step, love it. So, you ready? Charlie, right there. Back up. Here she comes. So it says, and I have to kind of walk you through it because I can tell the story as we're walking the journey. It tells me right there at the ABs and C's, like Bob so beautifully put it, is that you have to be convinced that you have a body and a mind that can never successfully drink, period. That's the only thing that's going to bring you to your knees to be willing to take this second surrender. And guys, it is a second surrender. The surrender to self will, I believe, today, was harder than to alcohol. Now, you couldn't have told me that when I was drinking. When I was in the midst of that pain. But self-will, I don't get it. What is it? What is it that you people want me to turn over? I mean, my argument was, I got to go to work. I got to raise the children. You know, I got a grocery shop. I got to pay the bills. I mean, what do you want me to do? See, I just didn't get it. And I believe, and this will raise a lot of feathers in here, and I'm a bit of a pot stirrer in this area. I believe that what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is that when the first surrender to alcohol has been removed, the compulsion is gone, the second surrender to self starts to surface. You start to get aware of it. And what happens, like Bob was saying, sex, drugs, money, another alcoholic in your life, and we turn to another 12-step program. That's what I think happens. Now, that can piss off a lot of people. God knows I have. I mean no disrespect. But it's like we try to manage another malady. Yeah, I want you to think about what I'm saying. It's important. You'll go to OA, you know, all the other programs out there, when in fact, it's self trying to manage self. Oh, I got another problem. Oh, I got another. Well, geez, there's 200 self-help programs. I mean, 12-step programs out there. So, what is the new one, honey? Lip Balm Anonymous? That's a hell of a malady. When you can't stop putting enough lip balm on that you need a 12-step program for. But you see what I'm saying is the third step is so powerful that when these other maladies come up, let's look at 60 to 63 deeply and see if you need another program because it says it'll answer all my problems. Well, I would certainly think sex, money, and another alcoholic in my life should be a problem, don't you think? So it says, Being convinced, we were at step three. Okay, they're asking for a lot, for you to be convinced on a lot of steps. It says the first requirement, that's pretty important information, is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. If you don't take this requirement and aren't convinced, you're not going to believe that on that basis we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. So you're telling me right here and right now, I can't even trust my motives? Absolutely not. Oh my gosh. Self-seeking motives are what are killing us. I mean, so many people try to work on their defects. They try just to be nice. Well, I'm only nice so I can get what I want. And the book says that I'll be more demanding or more gracious. I'm a chameleon. How many of you guys, when you drank, you went into a bar, you knew where the exit was, you knew if it was a male or female bartender, you saw who was over here, you knew where the bathrooms were, you saw who was going in the bathrooms a lot, if you needed to be in there at the right time, at the right place, are you following me? I mean, we're like smoke. Where do we need to go? What do we need to do? We're bobbing and weaving, bobbing and weaving. Now, you take away the drugs and alcohol, I'm a bobber and a weaver. I'm crafty. I'll get what I need. I'll get what I want. I just got to figure out how to work you. And I'll work you like a fiddle, won't I? See, that's where we're a room full. And if you think you can work on that, you absolutely cannot. If you have to go to another 12-step program, caution. Look at the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the hardest surrender in the whole wide world. And the closer you begin to get, especially with the sponsor, I love the way Bob talks about his sponsor, man, you got to stay so focused on so your troubles are of your own making. Because see, if my troubles are of Charlie's making, I'm in serious trouble. Because I got to get him to change for me to be okay, and that's a lot of work. Wouldn't you agree? But if my troubles are of my own making, if I'm the problem, I got a solution. If you're the problem, I got no solution. I can't even get you guys to hear what I'm saying. I've had people come up to me after a talk and say, you know, I don't agree with this, or you said this, or you touched my life in this way. I'm like, that wasn't even what I said. But it's what you heard. See, I'm absolutely powerless over what you hear me say. So, talk about having to give it up. So we're moving along. It says now, most of us try to live on self-propulsion. Yeah? Each person's like an actor who wants to run this whole show. Well, here's what an actor, it says, we're arranging the lights and the scenery, and somebody explained this to me one way that I loved it. We all basically know Hollywood, right? You know, I mean, you have some image of Hollywood, and there's extras in a movie, and you know, this, that, and the other, and they say we're doing a casting call for extras, we need 100 of them. We just want you to stand along the side over here while, you know, George Clooney and so-and-so come walking down the middle of the road. We just want you to stand there. Just look like a crowd, right? I'll take that job. So all of a sudden you're standing there and the director goes, okay, everybody ready? Extras ready? Okay, action. And they start walking and all of a sudden I'm one of the extras. And I go, whoa. Hold up. Cut. The director's like, who is that? I go, listen, I think we need to have them walking from the other side down this way. And I think it would be better if you split us both on each side of the road. And the name of this movie really sucks. I got a better idea. This person is, the director's going, who is this? See, that's what we do in life. The level of entitlement that we have as alcoholics. How many of y'all walk in a store and you could have laid it out way better? And why do we have 12 cash registers and only 4 people behind there? We should bring that to someone's attention. And this girl up here at this cash register is visiting entirely too long. I have places I need to go. See, we are so consumed with self that I don't even see it all over me, and the rest of the world does. And the book just walks into that beautifully. So it's talking about this actor, right? And it says, if his arrangements, going up to the top, page 61, if his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. There's the ultimate delusion. If you would do what I want you to do, we'd all be happy.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not thinking about you at all. I'm only thinking about me. See, I'm not thinking about your hopes and dreams and wishes. I just want you to behave the way I want you to behave. And then see, we'll all be happy. It says everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Isn't that great? Then, isn't that what most of the time you think your deal's going to be? You got this whole plan, and it gets kicked out, and the ducks get out of a row, and all of a sudden you're pissed off at somebody, and they go, what did I do? Well, you didn't do what I wanted you to do, that's for darn sure. Right? Or you lead out there by saying something to somebody, expecting them to say something back, and they don't say it, and you're mad. See, our whole life is like, if you smoke and you blow the smoke out, it just kind of goes through the air. We just infiltrate every aspect of everybody's being. And it's like Bob said, we are thinkers. If I say this, they'll say this. Oh, they didn't say this, so I better say that. Well, then if I say that, then they'll say this. And I mean, think. And in AA, the greatest way to see self-centeredness is to sponsor. Oh my God. If you have not had the gift of sponsorship so you can see the level of self-centeredness, it's unbelievable. Have you ever been really, really stressed out at a meeting and say you've got a hold of your sponsor and you've asked her to meet you there and you're talking to her and it's heavy. It's very heavy. I've got a pretty strong personality. You can tell when it's heavy. And one of your sponsees pops up and goes, hi. What are you doing? And you're like, oh my God. Can you not even just sense the energy here? You just want to go, you know, and they come up later and go, I am so sorry. Or I'll tell them, look, I only got a second. I'm just running in here. Okay, well, let me tell you. He said this, and then he said this, and I'm like, whoa, I don't have time to hear this. I mean, are you with me on this? You got to nod your head that you're getting this. Another beautiful way the book lays it out here is it says, it starts to say, here's the self-will toolkit. This is what I call it. Where it says, in trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous. He even bothers to himself sacrificing. Sure, I'll stay here. You just head on down the road. I'll take care of everything. I don't get my way, though. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. You bet. You're going to either get one side of me or the other side of me. You're going to probably get both. But if you don't do as I wish, and I sucked up to you, watch out. I will throw you under the bus so fast. Right? Especially if somebody's talking trash about you at the coffee machine. I'll look over and go, yeah, just a jerk. Right? See, don't ever misunderstand that we are no spiritual giants sitting here. We're just teaching the big book. I am as capable of talking trash about somebody as anybody. I don't like it. I'm asking God more and more every day to help remove me of this. But I would talk trash about people in Alcoholics Anonymous like that. I can't even believe it. I have a pretty strong spiritual program. But if I don't like you, and I haven't done inventory work on you, and somebody says, hey, so, did you hear so-and-so? I'm like, what? What did they say? Come on and nod your head a little bit. Be with me. Come to the light. Come off to the light. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Bob never talks trash about anybody. It's just me, but. And he's glowing over here. He really doesn't, let me tell you. I have yet to hear it, and I've tried to get him to talk trash, and I struggle. I know he's got other areas that he struggles in, but that one I'm quite impressed with. So it says, what? Not letting you off the hook that easy, Bob. What usually happens is the show doesn't come off very well, yeah? I mean, it's a show. When it says our little plans and designs, our ambitions, that's my day. I'm planning it. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. How many of y'all can relate to this? Katie decides to exert herself more. She becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious because I'm that chameleon. I gotta feel it out to decide how I gotta be. As the case may be, still the play doesn't suit her. Admitting she may be somewhat at fault, here's that self-righteous justification. She is sure other people are more to blame.
I become angry, indignant, and self-pity. I am so mad at you, I cannot believe that you had the audacity to say that about me. For indignant, for all I have done for you, especially if the sponsee decides to let you go. Don't try that one on, huh? I spent so much time with you. Oh, we'll just sit quiet with that one for a minute. Yeah, they call you and they say, you know what, this deal's not going to work out. I'm going to get so-and-so. Oh, you are, huh? That old ego boots up. Next thing you know, I spent so much time with them. I sacrificed so many. I pulled out of the Starbucks line just to talk to them. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Self-pity, all I ever do is help people in AA. They don't ever appreciate me for what it's worth. See, that's the voice in my head. I could do 100 scenarios for angry, indignant, self-pity. I just thought maybe you guys could relate to that one. So it says, what is the basic trouble? Is Katie really not a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? See, I made a commitment to God that I would take care of His kids. Period. The minute you piss me off in AA, I got to remember that I made this commitment to God. And the truth is it's, I hope it helps you, but I got to take you out of the equation because I'll really hold it at you. And here's an example. There was a guy who came to Austin and from another country. And he liked the AA he saw between Charlie and I. And he came up to us and said, I'd like to follow your AA. And he was only in town for a short while. And it reminded me of when we met Bob. Bob so graciously invited us into his world of AA. And I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. You're hurting? Here's my card. Call me. I pick up the phone. We'll talk. We'll talk for a long time. And so this guy said, I was wondering if Charlie could take me through the steps. And he looked at me and he said, but I want you to do a fifth step with me. I want to do multiple fifth steps. And Charlie's two buddies went, you want Katie to hear your inventory? Ooh. And I won't hear his sex inventory, but I'll hear his resentment inventory. And I thought, yeah. And Charlie's like, ooh, dude. And I thought, oh, I love 63. And so Charlie does 1, 2, and 3 with him. He's been sober 3 years. He does 1, 2, and 3 with him. And the next thing we know, he goes MIA. And Charlie's crazy busy with the conference he's got to go to. I'm going to Canada to speak. I'm crazy busy. I had set up Tuesday to do this inventory with him. He goes MIA. And I'm thinking, what the heck? Well, he comes back with a pretty lame excuse. I thought it was lame. I thought it was incredibly self-centered. You better be in the hospital. Period. Otherwise, why didn't you pick up a phone and tell us what the hell was going on? Right? Are you with me? Yeah, well, it's self-centeredness, right? You're seeing that? And so, he says, I am so sorry that I did this and put you in an awkward place. I hope I haven't missed my window to have you do the inventory with me. And I said, you know what, I'll fit you in on Thursday. And I'm telling you, I was fitting him in. Because I made a commitment to God to help his kids. I didn't want to help him. You really want to know the truth? I didn't want to help him. I promised God I would show up, period. No matter how inconvenient it was for me. So he sat down, and I'm pretty pissed that I'm taking my Thursday before I'm leaving the country. Are you following all of this? And I said to him, and he said, you know, I am sorry. And I thought, well, that ain't working. Okay, I am sorry ain't working for me. I want to tell you something. I made a commitment to do this inventory on Tuesday. I don't hear squat from you. I don't know if I'm seeing you on Tuesday or not. You've screwed that day up for me. I've now fit you in for Thursday, not because of you, but because I made a commitment to God that I'd show up for you. And he had a pen. I mean, he is gnawing on that pen, almost gnawing it in two. Because the truth of our self-centeredness is almost unbearable for us to see. Don't think I'm blinded to it. for my own self. I mean, I'm blind to my own level of self-centeredness, but I thought, you're not going to sit here and miss what you did to me. Now, open up that damn inventory and let me point out the rest of the train wreck that you are. And by God, he was a train wreck. And he had told Charlie he was struggling with seeing self at all. It was a train wreck. We're always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. He was just trying to get some good AA. Oh, I'll show you good AA. I'll hold your feet so to the fire they burn. Because I hope you'll do the same for me. My life depends on you telling me, as my sponsor, what I am doing. When you ask somebody to be your sponsor, I don't want you to be my friend. As a matter of fact, if I get a friendship, it's going to muddy the waters. You got to be able to tell me what I don't want to hear. Period. Right? You got to tell me so my problem. When I call my sponsor and I lay out a good thing about Charlie, oh, he's done me wrong. And I just know she's going to go, he is such a jerk. Right? Instead, she goes, well, let's see where you set the ball rolling, Katie. Didn't you hear how I laid that story out so beautifully? I'd actually worked on it before I even called her. Surely she was going to agree with me, yes? So this is the line, I believe, one of the main lines of untreated alcoholism, right? And it's the best. Is Katie not a victim? That's a powerful word. Have you ever been a victim in life? That's a terrible place to be, isn't it? It feels horrible. Hell, you could just have your house broken into. Never even saw the burglars or anything. And isn't it terrible to know that somebody had victimized you? It says, is he not a victim of the delusion? Which means I believe a lie, period. Just like the... I can tell you that you suffer from an allergy. I can tell you you suffer from a mental obsession. And that knowledge will not keep you sober. Got it? So you suffer from a delusion. That's what a delusion is. You can state the facts and I still believe the lie. And it says, so I am a victim of the delusion that I can rest. And that means to seize by force. That doesn't mean to lay down and take a nap. Satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. I mean, that should be tattooed on everybody's butt cheek, if you ask me. I mean, I really believe that we believe that to be true. If I just manage, it'll all come together. If I just get myself financially set, if I just get the right guy in my life, if I just get the right car, if I get the kid in the right school, if I get all of this, probably life will feel better. It talks about that in working with others in the family afterwards. Most people will try to get their finances in order. That's the most scariest one of all, is our finances. I'll have no place. The delusion takes over. I'll have no place to live. I'll have no... I will, oh my God, what will happen to me? Well, forget it. I know you guys have this great plan that you say God's going to be in charge. Forget it. I'm taking it from here, man. And so then it goes on and on and on. It says what the rest of the players are trying to snatch everything out of life. Do you think that director, when I stepped up as an extra, wasn't going, who is this person? How many of you guys have been in somewhere and everything's quiet and somebody's kind of disruptive? Which, of course, is probably one of us. And it would take another alcoholic to go, yeah, what's happening over there? Looks like... everybody else is quietly letting this pass. But, oh, no, not us. We got all. Don't you ever find that you're the person who has to say something? Someone has to say something. I'm the chosen one. And then it says, you know, it talks about our actor being self-centered, egocentric. Then it goes into the root of our problem. Selfishness and self-centered. Not stingy and conceited. See, that's always what I thought that meant. It means all I can think about is me. Period. Now, here's a perfect example. When Joe was diagnosed with his brain tumor, it's such a long story, I'll just fast forward. But we end up going in the emergency room. He has been messed up for 3 years. We can't figure it out. And I've ended up, because of the healthcare situation that we're in, I've had to drive a school bus on top of my fitness career to get some good medical insurance because I know he's sick. He needs serious medical attention, and we don't have the money. And so I'm not relying on God. I'm going to go drive a school bus because I can do that. And, you know, God can do whatever he's got to do, and we'll work together. So I drive this school bus with, by the way, you got to drive a school bus before you die. Forget jumping out of an airplane and all of that. You go drive a school bus. There is so much power in flipping out that stop sign. Little Mr. BMW. Thought you were in a big old hurry. Hop! Pass that baby down. Oh, my. But, I just love that school bus. But it was very, very challenging to get up at 5:30. I don't like getting up early in the morning. I don't like having somebody tell me what to do. I'm self-employed, right? I had a boss at the bus. And the one thing I did like was whacking the wheels. That was fun with that little deal that you whack the wheels every morning as if it's going to matter what the thump sounds like. And to me, I'm a woman, it all sounds the same. And so the doctor comes in, he says, puts his arm on my shoulder, he goes, my God. He has a massive tumor in his brain. Massive. And this is what the guy said. Huge. Massive. My God. It's gigantic. I thought, shut up. But my first thought was, my God, I'm going to drive that school bus forever. That's self-centered. It's not stingy and conceited. It's all I could think about. The first thought in my mind was, how is his tumor going to affect me? Now, granted, I didn't say that out loud, but that's what we're talking about. I'm the first one ever that I think about. So, extreme example of self-will run riot, though she usually doesn't think so. See, I'm going to take that. I jumped over there and I hugged him and I didn't go, go on, Kim, we were going to drive that bus. Can't let anybody see that level of me. And then my son is going through a terrible time after his father died. Oh, my God, I just wanted to hold his head underwater. My girlfriend said that to me one time, and she wasn't one of us. And I thought, oh, I already like you. Just that statement alone, I like you. But I needed to get him in counseling badly. He was really taking a hard left. And he wouldn't go. And I mean, I was going to duct tape him and throw him in the trunk of the car. I am a pretty tough gal. You're getting in that car. You're going to this counselor. Well, he'd been to him 3 times. He was also in the program, this counselor. And Sam was beginning to really like this guy. And I thought, thank you, God. I knew this is where he needed to be. You know, that's how I always use God. Ha! I'm a step ahead of you, God. You and me are like this when it's going good. And I get a phone call the day before Sam's 4th appointment. The counselor's had a heart attack and died. Like that. I love this man. My first thought was, can you believe he died on us? My first thought. We chuckle. Welcome to alcoholism. See, doesn't make me look very pretty, does it? But if I think those go away, I'm a victim of the delusion again. I just don't act on them. I got a whole toolkit over here that allows me to not act on them. But see, my old ideas, I thought that went away. I thought that self-centered thinking went away. So every time it pops up, I turn to self-pity. See, I'm still really not that person that these... I'm not a Bob Darrell. He's more spiritual than I. He's glowing. I'm not. I've had those terrible thoughts. There they are again. How can I ever be this spiritual giant when I think such ugly thoughts? Has anybody ever walked up to you and you look at me and think, oh, you bugged the crap out of me. Yeah, there it is. I'm telling you, it's just amazing. I've got about 7 more minutes, and then we're going to wrap it up. Okay, so, oh yes. So it says, now let me tell you how this plays out. It says, selfish and self-centered, that we think is the root of our troubles. I like to look at it as a tree. You got the root of a tree. You got the trunk, which I think is the fear. And then you got the branches and the leaves. Well, if I said, Bob, go out there and get rid of that tree. And he got a chainsaw, and, you know, and the tree fell down. I'd say, you did not get rid of that tree. He goes, it's gone. No, it's not gone. The root of the tree is still there. Well, Katie, that's a way bigger deal. You want me to get the root out? Have you ever tried to get the root out? You got to hire a company to come get the root out. They have this massive machine that gets the root out. That's a lot of work. That's what we're saying. There, you have to stay the course. Keep your thumb on the pulse if you want to get to that root of that problem. Otherwise, you're just trimming the branches. You're just cutting off the tree at the trunk. I think the root of our problem is all I can think about is me. It's driven by fear right up that tree trunk, right? The fear is the trunk. And the branches are, as the book will lay it out so beautifully, driven by 100 forms of fear. It could have said 1,000. People try to manage their fear. You absolutely will lose your mind if you try to manage your fear. When we're driven by our fear, you don't get to take over. Have you ever tried to take the wheel when someone else is driving? Oh, it's not going to be pretty. Because you're driven by the fear, and this is how it plays out. Once that self-centered kicks in, right? You see, that first thought is, my God, I'm going to drive this school bus. Driven by 100 forms of fear, I'm going to have to be on this bus till I'm 100 years old. These kids, I get a headache. They always get me sick. I love them to death. But you know what I'm saying? It's like somebody just flipped on the movie and it's starting to roll and it plays out just like this. It goes into the delusion, the lie. I begin believing this lie, this storyline. It's like I'm sitting in the movie theater. I go into self-seeking because now I believe this movie that has taken place. In my mind, I've not even left my chair. And I realize, my God, I better go take care of all these things because of this delusional lie that I'm playing out in my life. I mean, in my mind. And then what happens after that? I go to self-pity. Now, in self-seeking, I step on the toes of my fellows. And they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seeming without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, I've made a decision based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. See, I made a decision based on self that's going to cause me to get hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of our self, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self will run riot, comma, though he usually doesn't think so. When we talk about being blinded by self, that's what it's talking about. Have you ever raised a strong-willed child? Come on, raise your hands if you got a strong-willed child. You know, oh my God, you can beat them within an inch of their life. You can talk to them about their feelings. You can take their door off their room, their mattress out of their room. You can do everything. Can't break them, can you? That self-will is so strong. So you take that group of self-will, and you put it right here. And then you pluck out of that the most extreme example of that group of self-will. Welcome to the people who are sitting in this room. That's us. And if you don't think so, it's because you're delusional. If you don't think you're self-centered, you're delusional. Work with me for a week. I'll point it out. I'll point it out over the weekend for you if you need me to. It's unbelievable. Because this is the root of our problem. I had no idea that the second surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous would be the surrender to self. It's all I see. Selfish is everywhere. And one of the things, I called Bob one time and I said to him, I'm like, oh my God, Bob, I'm so hard on my sponsees. I'm beating them. You know, any of y'all been that way with your sponsees before? Just want to beat them over the head with the book. And he said, Katie, start praying the prayer of growing understanding and effectiveness. I don't know if you even remember telling me that. And I thought, because I so admire, you see that humility.
Brain damage.
I read it as humility. But it was one of those things where I went, okay, I'll do that. And that was such the key to me being able to have compassion to your self-centeredness, because I got it too. See? So, wrapping this up, it says, this is crucial, right? This whole thing just goes on forever and ever. It says, many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore. There it comes again. I always tell the truth. I never lie. Oh, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You lie and you don't even know you lie. Right? So, it's like, oh, I'd love to think I'm this incredibly spiritual person that I don't do anything that I won't do. And anytime I start that tone in my head, I know I'm in trouble. But we couldn't live up to them no matter how we'd like to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. So if you're working on your character defects, hang that up. Right? Hang it up. You've got to act like somebody whose prayers have been answered. But you've got to ask God to help you remove that. You don't get to do that. You do get to go out there in the world and quit being such a jerk. Right? So it says, here's the terms we make. He lays out the terms so beautifully in this. If you get it in a marriage, you're to love and to cherish the rich or poor, be faithful, right? You have all the terms while you're standing up there getting married. You screw up those terms, you might screw up the marriage. Wouldn't you agree? Yeah, you go have an affair, could be a deal breaker. With me, it definitely is. Right? Made that real clear. I stood right there in front of God and said, that's a deal breaker. You lose all your money, I'm sticking with you. Right? The terms we make in that marriage. You go into a job and they say you got to show up at 8 o'clock. You start showing up at 8:30. Those are not the terms we made, are they? Probably going to lose that job. Well, here's what God says. First, you got to quit playing Him. Well, I almost set that one aside because that's almost just too difficult to grasp. It really is, isn't it? That's too big. We're going to set it aside. Help me work with the other ones. Because I'm still just trying to get unblocked. So it says up at the top of page 63, when we sincerely took such a position, that position that we were going to quit playing God, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all powerful. He provided what we needed. That sounds like taking away my problems, doesn't it? He provided the money, the relationship, everything. He provided what we needed. If we kept close to Him, here's your terms, and performed His work well, which means I got to do 4 through 9 to get unblocked. I got to live in the maintenance of 10 and 11, and I got to help His kids, the 12th step, perform His work well. You must help God's children. That's why He wants you to be here. Period. So that's what I tell people. Stay close to Him and perform His work well. Is that what we're doing? Or are we too busy with her? Are we too busy with him? Are we too busy trying to find that job? Are we too busy bitching about politics? Oh, that's the one that makes me crazy. It says, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. There's what Bob was talking about. Those are the third step promises right there. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. What? You mean I'm going to actually think about what I can do instead of what I can take? As we felt new power flow in, that's the only part where it says that we're going to begin to feel something. It says we enjoy peace of mind. That's what we're all looking for. That to me was what the drink did. I took the drink and it gave me peace of mind. All I want is peace of mind. I can't stop the problems of the world, but I can have peace of mind while they're coming at me. Almost every promise in the steps gives you peace of mind. It's the greatest gift in the whole wide world. It'll bring you to tears when you feel it. It talks about how we can face life successfully. Then we look at the third step prayer. And guys, when it says in this third step prayer, you don't take somebody from the second step to on their knees. They don't get it. They don't even know what the prayer is about. You've got to at least give them an idea of what self looks like. It says that I offer myself to thee to build with me, which means it's a process. and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. If, I don't know if any of y'all have ever done bondage, but let me tell you. You want to be a victim, there's some victim there. Now, you all went sexual on that, didn't you?
No, you did.
No, I just said bondage. The word bondage means slavery. See, bondage always ties to... It's old ideas, I'm telling you. If you've ever been in bondage, you know what I'm talking about. Of course, I was playing with y'all on that. But that's what I'm saying is, you find yourself tied with your hands tied, you're not going anywhere. And that's what this is. You're in bondage of self up in that mind. How many of y'all have laid in bed for 3 hours and you can't stop your brain? That's bondage, absolutely. I'll give you a tip right now. Best thing to do for that is to mantra a prayer. God help me. And don't stop. You may have to do it for an hour. God help me, 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 God help me. Only take a breath. God help me, God help me, God help me, God help me. You'll fall asleep. It's unbelievable. I found that out when I was in bondage itself. And then it says, that I may better do your will. So relieve me of the bondage itself only so I can better do your will, not so I can feel better. Take away my difficulties. That victory over them can bear witness to those I would help. So you take away my problems, then I end up leaving AA because life got good. I didn't fulfill the rest of my commitment, did I? It's unbelievable, guys. I hope you take 60 to 63. Read it. Ask for the new experience. Do the set-aside prayer. Help me have a new experience. Go to your sponsor if they're not holding your feet to the fire and say, please make every problem I bring you of my own making. Do not give me an out. Do not give me any wiggle room. Because you're putting a nail in my coffin. And so most people mean well and they don't know it. So I hope that was helpful. Thanks.
Thanks, Katie. We're going to take a 1 hour and 53 minute break. Be back at 2 o'clock.